Hey there. We at Blue Wire wanted to thank you for your continued support of this podcast. With over 90 podcasts across our network, we are committed to bringing you great content to fill that sports-shaped hole in your heart. To find more Blue Wire Pods, search for us on iTunes or check out BlueWirePods.com. And remember, one day sports will return and it will be glorious. Thanks for listening. On to the show.
Hello Bulls fans and welcome to another episode of Bulls HQ, a Chicago Bulls podcast on the Blue Wire Sports Podcasting Network. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the show. We are brought to you today by Bet Online. Thank you to them for sponsoring the show, and thank you to you for joining us on this episode of the show, which is bound to be a pretty eventful one for Fred and I, given that the Bulls have just put in place their new general manager, Arturis Karnišovas, and they're going to work as per usual. Already putting in place his GM, he has signed Mark Eversley from the Sixers to be his new general manager. Fred and I will get into that as well as episodes 3 and 4 of The Last Dance. So let's get straight into it and let's bring in the Scottie Pippen to my Michael Jordan. He is Fred Pfeiffer. Fred, how are you, sir?
Oh, I'm living the dream, Mark. Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan, I think it's important that we first start out with the very advanced scientific test that NBC Sports Chicago offered, where we did a personality test to find out what bull you were most like, and surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, I found it to be expected. I ended up being Michael Jordan. You were Jerry Krause. What say you?
I knew that was going to...
Isn't it perfect, considering how you were defending Krause all week?
I knew you were, so you weren't going to let me let that slide on this episode of the show. I mean, I was stupid for putting that online, but I just wanted to prove my integrity. Unlike most people, who's probably doing that test a million times over until they put in the correct answers, until the algorithm spat out Michael Jordan or Scottie Pippen or someone of greater character than Jerry Krause. But I did it one go. That was the answer I got. Because I'm a man of integrity, I shared my results with the public. Unfortunately, it was Jerry Krause, which I'm blaming on NBC Sports, not my answers.
Well, I will admit you are a good man. You are the Jerry Krause of Bulls podcasters. The funniest part about this, I literally know probably 100 people who took that test. You're the only guy I know who got Jerry Krause. But,
oh man,
it's so classic. So where are we, man? Where are we
that's
talking
disappointing.
About?
I mean, we'll come back and talk about more about Jerry Krause, Michael Jordan, and The Last Dance on the second half of this show. But I thought it made sense to start with the recent news of the Bulls hiring Mark Eversley of the Sixers. He's currently the Senior Vice President of Player Personnel with the Philadelphia 76ers. He has been hired by Arturis Karnišovas to be his general manager. So that news dropped maybe a couple hours after the airing of episodes 3 and 4 of The Last Dance. I wasn't expecting that to come after that, but the Bulls and Karnišovas doing work. Obviously watched episodes 3 and 4 and then decided to make the signing of Mark Eversley a little bit later on. What are your initial thoughts about this? I'm assuming you're asleep when this news broke, given it probably came through at around midnight Chicago time. But what are your initial thoughts on Mark Eversley becoming the Bulls' new general manager?
Well, he was off my radar. I had no idea who he was. I can only tell you what I felt about the 76ers moves over the past few years, and they're not great. I got to tell you, Mark, I'm not really impressed with the moves. Like, I'd like to know what Gar Pak's move was worse than moving up from 3 to draft Markel Fultz at number 1 overall. Like, what compares to that? You know, that said, who knows whose decision was that? He was hired by Brian Colangelo. You know, who knows how much of the decisions that Brian Colangelo made that were good were part of, you know, Mark's decisions. So, you know, it's really hard to tell. I'm going to give him – all I can tell you is I'm going to be open keep an open mind about how he does from this point forward for the beloved Bull, and I'm looking forward that he's joining the organization. Big picture, we just needed a new direction. We needed a new new thought process coming in here. And I think big picture also, AK is going to make most of the decisions that really matter, and hopefully Mark will, you know, help him achieve greatness.
Yeah, I completely agree. So my initial thoughts when it came through, I mean, Eversley was one of the names that was linked to the general manager position along with the likes of Michael Finley. I think Mark Hughes from the Clippers and maybe Matt Lloyd was the other one from the Magic who had previous ties to the Bulls or was previously a Bulls employee at one point. So they were the names that were rumored to be the ones that were going to be linked to that general manager position. To be fair, I didn't know much about most of those guys in terms of the moves that those people have made by themselves, and that is because most of these guys have probably been more assistant type GMs in the past, where to your point, it's always kind of hard to ascertain what move was theirs versus what move was the ultimate decision maker. But in Philadelphia, he was, you know, the senior vice president of player personnel working under Brian Colangelo, and to your point, I haven't been thrilled with what the Sixers have done from a management perspective over the last 18 to 24 months. I think the way they've sort of been managing that team and the way they've built that team has been pretty much a joke over the last sort of 12 months at least. I think we saw that sort of play out on the basketball court this season. But again, I'm prepared to give Eversley a pass on that, given that their ownership is heavily involved, given Elton Brand is the rookie GM. He's obviously making decisions, but Brett Brown is also involved. So it seems like that's an environment where there's too many chefs. So I don't know how much of that, of the poor decisions made by the Sixers, is to be blamed purely on Eversley. But it is, I guess, a concern of sorts, the fact that he's part of the Brian Colangelo tree of executives is somewhat of a concern as well. But again, to your point, he's not going to be the lead decision maker here in Chicago. That is still going to be Arturis Karnišovas. And I'm prepared to put some faith in Eversley based on Karnišovas, you know, picking him out to be the Bulls GM. And look, we don't really know much about Eversley or anyone else that was sort of going through this process. We'll learn more of that about them as we go forward here. But I'm trusting AK on this one.
Yeah, Ty Bull was a nice draft pick for them this year. I think where he was picked at, you know, I like that player. But, you know, Al Horford signing in retrospect looks like a massive mistake. Tobias Harris looks like a huge, horrific mistake. I mean, those are clear mistakes that this organization made, letting Jimmy Butler go probably and choosing to spend money on Harris over Butler in retrospect was a massively, poor decision. So, you know, who knows what kind of influence he had in those decisions. Let's hope for our sake that it was, had a lot more to do with Elton. But, you know, overall, the organization's been successful, you know, since he's been there. Overall, you know, I think you know, they haven't really got to an Eastern Conference final, but let's just hope that everything works out. And you know, I will admit, though, I was disappointed Finley didn't get the job. With Chicago ties, I thought he would have been a perfect guy. But, you know, they went in a different direction, so we'll see how it works out.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Sixers are set up pretty well thanks to your mate Sam Hinkie, so I think that certainly helps. Yeah. But, look, I kind of felt the same way, that for no real reason I wanted Finley involved because he has those Chicago ties. But again, I don't really know much about Michael Finley, the executive. Similarly with Mark Eversley, the executive, I don't know a ton. But for whatever reason, I was drawn to Michael Finley, most likely given to those Chicago ties. So yeah, I kind of felt the same. I wasn't disappointed when the news came through. It was a little bit taken aback because I wasn't expecting it as such. But well, I mean, ultimately we'll see how it all plays out. It'll be interesting to hear from him. He's never been a general manager before. This is essentially a promotion from him. I'm not sure when the Bulls are going to do a live press type, a press conference, an introductory press conference with Mark Eversley. I'm assuming they will do one, but who knows when that'll happen. If it does happen, obviously it will be happening over Zoom, but who the hell knows. But yeah, noteworthy piece of news as Karnišovas sort of builds out his front office here. He's got his general manager in place. He's obviously hired his assistant general manager in JJ Polk. He's brought over Pat Connolly to be a vice president of player personnel here with the Chicago Bulls. He followed Karnišovas over from Denver. So slowly but surely, the front office is taking shape. He still needs to make his decisions on those that still remain with the organization. And I'm thinking about Brian Hague, and I'm thinking about about Jim Paxson, old Johnny Boy's brother, and Steve Wyman as well, head of the analytics team as well. So there's still some moves that are probably going to happen from a front office perspective, but slowly but surely, kind of Chauvis's front office is starting to be filled out. I guess the next decision, Fred, will be what he does with his coaching staff. And I guess we'll only know once we find out for sure that the NBA season is officially done. But I guess there's some news about with certain states in the US, and you're probably more familiar with this than I would be, but some states are reopening as of May 1, if I'm led to believe that is correct. And to that point, there may be certain states that may be where there are NBA teams that will enable those sort of teams to get back and practice and, you know, do those sorts of things. That ultimately be up to the team to see what happens if they allow that to happen. Obviously, it's a different situation to Chicago and Illinois, but who knows when the NBA season will be officially cancelled, if it is at all. But I guess that's what kind of Chauvis is waiting on to make a decision on his coaching staff.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some news in the NBA. I haven't had a chance to finish listening to the last Ringer with Bill Simmons, but it sounds like there is some movement towards finishing the season at, you know, I'm guessing it would be at some location either in Florida or Las Vegas, a central location where, you know, similarly what they're doing in China in some of these areas where there's massive projects being done. There's a zone, a quarantine zone where, you know, I guess you could envision family of the players could come in and finish out the season playing all the way through to the finals. That idea kind of excites me. You know, just for the fact that I think it would be incredible if they did build a facility or a court specifically designed for television, for even 3D, for, you know, for all the really cool devices that we currently have. I think that'd be really neat if they did that, but I'm just starving for any type of real sports. And I do think that, you know, hopefully if we can somehow get past or figure out what you know, advanced testing would help us decide that we can do something like that. I think it would be really helpful for the psyche of the country.
Yeah, I think it's a fair point, assuming obviously they can do it safely. Georgia is one of those states that is reopening pretty soon. I'm sure there's others around that I'm clearly missing, not being based in the US. But there are a few states that are reopening soon. Obviously, some of those states contain some NBA teams. So it'll be interesting to see if that provides any competitive advantages at all in terms of some states opening earlier than others, having that ability to get their teams together, or at least allowing their players to get into training facilities a little bit earlier than maybe some other states will. So I don't know how it's all going to work out, but I'm not... I don't believe there's going to be much NBA, if there is going to be any NBA at all. I don't think it'll affect our Chicago Bulls, but what it may... In terms of the Bulls coming back this season, we may get some playoffs or something like that. But ultimately, what it does mean, if the end regular season is over, then kind of Chauvis gets some sort of, well, not just kind of Chauvis, but the rest of the league, they get some sort of notice as to what they need to be thinking going forward, whether they should be, you know, fully planning for the draft, whether they should be scouting, pro scouting, given that the season potentially is still going. But more importantly for us Bulls fans is understanding if the season is truly over, then there may not be a need to keep old Jim boiling around, which is hopefully the next big news piece of news that we get through in time. But we shall see.
Just really quick, I did want to say, for what I heard that there is talk about going to 70 games. So every team would finish at 70, and that would be the final standings, which would require all the teams to go back and to play up to 70 games. The Bulls have played, I believe, 65 games, so they would technically have five more games. Teams like the Lakers have only played 63. I think teams like Dallas have almost played 67 or 69. So it would kind of vary, but I think that's the initial talk right now, is that they're going to try to get 70 games in. So with that in mind, I think it would be kind of cool to see the Bulls for five more games, you know, hopefully by now, completely, hopefully Dunn will be able to finish the season for five games, and hopefully most of the guys on the team are going to be healthy and ready to go. I think it would be a good thing for us to at least catch like five games and see if Kobe's still on and Zach, you know, can kind of put some minutes together to at least give AK like one last look before he makes some off-season decisions.
Am I a bad fan for not caring if the Bulls come back or not, particularly if it's only like for a five game stretch to finish the season? Like, is there anything to be learned over a five game stretch when the players have had so much time off, and anything, you know, to be learned that we don't already know about this team? And To be honest with you, I just haven't missed Bulls basketball, particularly as we're going through the Last Dance and being reliving the 90s dynasty. Like, I just have no interest in watching the current group of Bulls at the moment, particularly if Jim Boylan is still coaching the team. So am I a bad fan for feeling that way?
I would say yes. I would still like to see the last five. I'd still like to get together and see what they can do. You know, one interesting point I did want to make, to me, the most accurate kind of indicator of a team's talent is point differential. And out of all the teams in the East, the Bulls have by far, the teams in the playoff, not in the playoffs, have the lowest differential. So they're a minus 3.1, which means they've been not scored on an average of 3.1 points. To give you an idea, the Hornets are minus 6.7. And they're ahead of the Bulls. So I think that's a good sign. And the two worst teams in the conference, the Hawks and Cavs, are minus 7.9. I think the Bulls are a little bit closer than we're led to believe.
Yeah, they're clearly underachieving, and they might be a good ninth seed. That's what you're telling me, right?
Pretty good.
Unfortunately, only eight teams qualify for the playoffs. But maybe next season, Fred. Maybe next season, whenever a new season is. But yeah. Interesting news that Woj dropped yesterday, last night. The Bulls have their GM in place. We'll see what happens thereafter going forward. But hopefully not too much longer before we get the inevitable news. I say inevitable, I'm trying to will it into existence that Jim Boylan is gone. But we shall see. But Fred, I want to talk about The Last Dance now. That's the real reason us Bulls fans are pretty amped at the moment. I want to get into episodes 3 and 4. But before we do that, let's tell the listeners about this week's sponsor. With currently no NBA, NHL, or MLB, you might think there's nothing to bet on. Well, you'd be wrong. Our exclusive partner, BetOnline, still has hundreds of events, games, and props to wager on. From their online casino to poker and blackjack, they are bringing Vegas to you. Missing the NFL? Then no problem. BetOnline has live, daily Madden NFL 20 simulations that you can bet on. You can also still bet on Survivor, Big Brother, American Idol, stock prices, and even Nathan's hot dog eating contest. All of that is open 24 hours a day, and all of it is online. Go to betonline.ag and use promo code BLUEWIRE to join today and receive your new welcome bonus. BetOnline, your online wagering solution. All right, back to the podcast now. Let's get into episodes 3 and 4 of The Last Dance. Frederick, what did you make of it? Episodes were pretty much centered around the Bad Boys, Dennis Rodman, even some Phil Jackson in there, and of course how that all affected the worlds of Michael and Scotty. How did you feel about episodes 3, 4 in its unison, but more bringing it more together as a collective in how it sort of fit with episodes 1 and 2?
I thought all the parts discussing Doug Collins and the Bad Boy Pistons and basically the Bulls from 1986 to 1990 was absolutely fantastic. Probably for me, the best, most enjoyable watch of the entire series. The Rodman stuff was interesting, but I knew a lot of that already. I think it is kind of interesting that it kind of juxtaposed, Rodman with the Bulls and some of the amazing stuff about him deciding just to go for a vacation in Vegas during the season and him not actually returning. That was all hilarious stuff, but I kind of all knew that.
Yeah.
The revelations that meant the most to me was, number one, I thought it was really interesting how Doug Collins, I always kind of felt that the reason Doug Collins was fired because he went around Jerry Krause, directly to Jerry Reinsdorf, who he always had a good relationship with, to basically advocate the drafting of Horace Grant. It wasn't just him, but his entire staff wanted Horace. Jerry Krause wanted Joe Wolf. And he took a big risk by doing that, going around Jerry Krause. And I think Jerry Krause won. In my head, that's the reason he was unjustly fired. I don't think anybody can make a good case that it was justified. In retrospect, sure, it looks great, but at the time, it was appalling. And then it really hit me in this episode. I thought they did a great job, which I did not recall, was Doug Collins' efforts to minimize Tex Winter. Several years ago, I had the pleasure of interviewing Roland Lazenby for the Chicago Bulls. Unfortunately, it's never aired publicly. I still need to do a ton of work on it since the recording was so horrible and the connection was bad on his end. But one of the points he made was about Jerry Krause's love for Tex Winter and a triangle offense. And he also said that Jerry, the most hurt he ever was in his job as general manager, was when Tex Winter left for the Los Angeles Lakers, and I think the 2000 season, to reunite with Phil. It really portrayed, I thought, Tex Winter and Phil kind of saddling up to Jerry Krause and utilizing his love for the triangle and for Tex Winter's basketball philosophy. I think it kind of showed that Doug, that's why Doug left and that's why Doug was fired, and that he didn't believe in the triangle. He believed, as I do, that you need to take what your talents are, how your team is structured, and build an offense around your talent. Whereas a triangle is a system. And you don't adapt the talent to the system, you adapt the system to the talent. That's what the triangle is. I believe in adapting the system to the talent. The triangle is adapting the talent to the system. So it's just a philosophical basketball difference, and that led to his firing. What surprised you?
Yeah, I thought that was probably the biggest one, and that was interesting to me because I feel like if Doug Collins was more receptive to Tex Winter, then maybe we never get Phil Jackson. Maybe Doug Collins keeps coaching, and maybe Doug Collins is the guy that has 3, 4, 5, 6 championships, whatever it might be, in an alternate reality. But he was obviously very steadfast in his decision not to embrace the triangle, not to embrace Tex Winter at all. And they had the scenes there where Tex was sort of coaching away from the team. He was, during the games, he wasn't sitting on the bench. During practice, he was way away taking notes, nowhere near Collins. So that was an interesting scenario. Clearly, they made the right decision in bringing in Phil Jackson and keeping Tex Winter around. So we can mock Jerry Krause as much as we like, but he clearly got that decision right. But yeah, I was wondering because...
Well, how do you know? Is it possible Doug Collins could have won 8 titles in a row? I mean,
I would assume it's impossible, yeah.
Okay. I sat with Horace Grant and asked him this very question. I go, do you think the Bulls would have won titles with Doug Collins? He said unequivocally yes. So Horace is telling, yes, we would have won with Doug. You're telling me, no, we would not have won with Doug. Who am I going to believe?
Clearly me, obviously.
Okay, exactly.
No, but I mean, I think that was very key in that whole episode as well. The fact that they, part of bringing in Phil and part of bringing in Tex Winter and the triangle was maybe getting away and decreasing that workload on Michael Jordan and in part elevating his teammates, which in turn made Scottie Pippen the player he was, Horace the player he was. Obviously, there was going to be a natural progression for those players anyway, given that they were young at that point. But I think that fostered their growth, the fact that they were unable to do more in the triangle than maybe they would have been. Maybe would have been the case in an ISO-heavy Doug Collins offense that focused entirely around Michael Jordan. So I don't know. It's an interesting philosophical question. We can go back and forward on it. I tend to agree with the way it all transpired. I thought it was the right decision. I was actually thinking about this when I was watching this, because I know you're a big, big, big Doug Collins fan, but to me, it's interesting that you are, because he is a bit of a psychopath on the sidelines, which they clearly identified or sort of highlighted through the show, the fact that he's so intense on the sideline. In a way, he reminds me of a Tom Thibodeau type in that sense. But you detest Tibbs, but love Doug Collins. I found that dichotomy very interesting.
That's very interesting. You called me out for that, I guess. Well, I would have if Doug Collins, had averaged 43 minutes for Noah over the course of a December 2012 stretch, I probably would have felt as equally angry about Doug. No, but there's no denying this. Like, this is as someone who lived through it, and you have no concept of this, or anybody who's younger. But the Bulls were, again, kind of a loser mentality. They won 30 games in Michael's second year after the injury, and although he did great things, in the playoffs, there was still that loser attitude. And I just felt like it was like a seismic shift in from being losers to, winning, beating Cleveland and actually starting to scare the Pistons. And I thought Doug Collins had a ton to do with that. I thought he was a fantastic coach. Everywhere he went, the team got considerably better. And I thought his firing was completely unjustified. I was going back and forth with some guy on Twitter, and he was like, the Bulls plateaued under Collins. I'm like, what evidence is there of that? Doug Collins lost to Detroit 4-1. The next season, they went to the Eastern Conference Finals and lost 4-2. He was then fired. Phil Jackson took over and lost in the Eastern Conference Finals 4-3. Call me crazy. If you do the math, it looks like they were on the same linear path as they were under Doug as under Phil. Like, it's such a dumb argument. Like, I don't believe that the Bulls would have suddenly lost. Who knows? Maybe they would have won Game 7. And the offense was structured completely around Michael Jordan instead of running the stinking triangle with Scottie shooting 1-10, B.J. Armstrong 1-8, and Horace Grant shooting 3-17. I'm just telling you this. There's one thing that's a fact, and people, this is, I thought there were a couple misleading things about the documentary. Number one, the triangle was run in the first quarter. It was never run in the fourth quarter when games, you know, really the big winning and losing of these games mattered. You think they went to the freaking triangle in the last shot against Utah, game six, that Michael, I didn't see any triangle being run there. It was every game that mattered in the fourth quarter. It was get the ball to Michael and everybody get the F out of the way, as Doug so eloquently put it. And that's the way it should have been. They ran a triangle in the first quarter, and it gave confidence to other players. I understand why they did it. But, in games that mattered in the fourth quarter down the stretch, let's watch the videotape, point out where they're running the stinking triangle.
But you can argument with literally every offensive system at some point, assuming you have that talent available, that it's always going to come back to some half-court isolation. And why would it not when you have Michael Jordan, particularly in those possessions? But the point is, obviously, the preceding 47 minutes or whatever it might be, obviously going Michael ISOs for most of the game versus, containing that for the last 5 minutes or whatever it might be, that's clearly the difference. And that's where Doug Collins clearly got it wrong. And that's why he justifiably was fired, in my opinion. But, I mean, Collins was good. I'm not saying he wasn't a good coach, but to me, he's very similar to a Scott Skiles in the sense that he's someone that you can bring in for a 2-4 year period, but eventually at some point he's probably going to get burnt out. I mean, you look at his coaching career, at every stop he had, he never lasted more than 3 seasons at every job. And that's probably because he was so intense and just so steadfast in his ways that he wasn't willing to adapt. And I think that's pretty clear for Doug Collins. But to me, I was thinking watching that back is maybe if he was more willing to accept Tex Winter and Phil Jackson, and Collins sort of alluded to it that by his second season, he felt that Phil Jackson could run the team. And the way I interpreted it, because Collins was being specifically cagey about it and didn't want to necessarily go into the details of the senses that he was feeling as to why Phil Jackson could run the team by Collins' second year, it did feel like based on the way the documentary was sort of positioning it, that Phil was being groomed as Doug Collins' successor while Doug was still on the job, which may or may not be true. I don't know if that was the case, but that was what was inferred by the documentary.
We'll never know, but there's no denying the results of Phil Jackson taking over were splendid. And I think in retrospect, it's probably likely that Doug could not have replicated what Phil was able to do. So I don't think that diminishes Doug Collins as a coach. I think he's an excellent coach. And I think if he was their choice in 2008, as John Paxson wanted, instead of Vinny Del Negro, the Bulls would have been in a much better position. There's one other thing, though, about the show last night I really think was kind of undersold. And that was the ramifications of that Eastern Conference loss on June 3rd, 1990, the quote-unquote migraine game for Scottie Pippen. Scottie Pippen was terrible in that game. He told everyone that he had a migraine. Unfortunately, didn't seem, most of the people I know that had migraines are usually chronic conditions that happen often. So it was really unfortunate that the only migraine he seemed to have in his career happened to coincide with the biggest game of his life up until that point. But he was 1-10 in that game and really didn't show up. I sense Michael in that cut had some doubts about whether or not, there was really a migraine, or maybe it was just the moment was too big for him and that led to a headache. I'm not denying that he had a headache, but he played 42 minutes, was 1-10, and the surrounding cast failed Michael Jordan in that game. There's no denying it. B.J. Armstrong was 1-8, Horace Grant was 3-17, and at that point in Chicago history, I maintain it was the greatest or biggest loss in the history of Chicago sports up to that point. The only one that compares to it is the Bartman game of 2003 that the Cubs lost in 2003, game six against the Florida Marlins. What say you?
I knew you were going to bring this up, and I in part wanted to definitely talk to you about this, because to me, I understand the knock that Pippen received in terms of the backlash that he received, I guess, let's put it that way. But to me, the way he was sort of explaining the injury, if we want to call it that, or his ailments, it was conducive of what you would expect from a concussion. The fact that he was blacking out and couldn't necessarily see, couldn't necessarily go out there and play as such. To me, I think it sort of undersells it to say he had a headache, and that was the reason why he was 1 of 10 in 42 minutes, considering he was in the lead up into game 7, he was pretty good for the majority of that series against the Pistons. So to me, I'm sensing that you may be believing that maybe Scotty had a bit of a choking incident in game 7. Are you trying to say that without necessarily questioning Scotty's greatness?
I think Scotty's one of the greatest defensive players of all time. I do feel he sometimes struggled, especially at that point in his career, in rising to the occasion. And there's no arguing that he played 42 minutes with this horrible condition. And as bad as it was, if you go back, I think context is everything. If you go back and look at it, he was 1 year away from a contract that was up for negotiation. There was a very big game up to that point, and he failed miserably. Migraine or not, he failed. There's no arguing that. And Michael Jordan, Jordan had 15 field goals. I think the rest of the team combined had 17. Like, it was for a team like the Detroit Pistons, who, you know, people, what's the most hated team in our memory, Mark, as Bulls fans? Probably the Heat, would you say?
Probably.
The
Heat.
It was the hatred I had for the Detroit Pistons was times 20 than what I had for the Heat. Yeah. I respect the Heat. I dislike them, but I respect them. I didn't respect the Pistons. Pistons had two fantastic offensive players in Isaiah Thomas and Joe Dumars. Mark Aguirre probably less so at that point of his career. And they had nothing but bums that just were limited physical disgraces of humans, like Bill Laimbeer out there trying to play bully far superior athletes and players into submission to win games. It was disgusting. And I get so sick of this attitude from the Pistons, like, you know, the NBA, you know, they didn't want us to win. Well, no, nobody wanted you to win because you weren't that stinking good outside of those two players. You won because of intimidation and bullying other people. It doesn't take a lot of skill for when a great player, you saw it in the clip there. You saw Dominique Wilkins take to the air. They knocked him down. Who else was in those clips?
Yeah, Doc Rivers went down and won.
And you saw what they did to Scottie Pippen, what Rodman did to Scottie Pippen. I mean, have you ever seen a cheap shot like that? What was your impression viewing those, if you haven't seen those before? And how could you possibly say, oh, that was a great team?
I want to say this first. I don't want those singular moments from the Pistons to undersell that they were a good team, because they clearly were a good team. They were a great defensive team as well. I mean, they had Rodman, they had a whole bunch of other guys that were good defenders on that team. They were clearly talented and what good enough to be one of the better NBA teams in the NBA. But like you, I absolutely detest the Pistons. I had some very disparaging comments. I made them about Bill Laimbeer as I was watching episodes 3 yesterday, because I just hated his freaking face. Just looking at that dumbass and the way he would just go through and just clobber guys. It was one play. He clobbered Larry Bird, absolutely clobbered him, and Bird reacted, and he was justifiably right to react the way he did to Bill Laimbeer. And, oh, man, I hated that guy more than most. He may be my most hated player of all time now that I think about it. I mean, if I think about all the other teams that the Bulls have come across, and, you know, I know a lot of Bulls fans dislike and hate LeBron James, but you think about what the way LeBron carries himself versus the way the Pistons and guys like Bill Laimbeer carry themselves. It's not even a competition. So I can't stand the Pistons. And that was probably the most illuminating thing as well, apart from the Doug Collins stuff, was they went into detail about how to guard Jordan and the Jordan rules and all that sort of stuff. And I was just watching it and just had this visceral feeling of wanting to just clobber Bill Laimbeer in the face with a 2x4. That was my overwhelming feeling watching episodes 3 and 4.
Yeah, he was such an entitled piece of crap. His father was like a CEO of a company. comes from the lap of luxury, and he's such a limited piece of dung. And, you know, like, that's he basically survived in the league with a good jump shot and fear. He intimidated other players by – there was always a thought they could be cheap. And Rick Mahorn was the same way. There's a great clip that I'm surprised they didn't show where Jordan was basically thrown out of the air by – I think it was Rick Mahorn. Oakley jumps in and starts taking him on, and Doug Collins got thrown on a scorer's table. Did you ever see that clip, Mark? It's a must watch.
I feel like they had that one in episode 1 and 2 when they were showing the bit about Charles Oakley. I don't know if they cut it during the bad boy scenes in episodes 3 and 4, but I feel like there was a scene in episodes 1 and 2 when they were talking about trading Oakley for Bill Cartwright, where they were talking about Oakley being Jordan's enforcer and how he was always stepping in for him. And I maybe I'm wrong, but I remember a scene where Oakley was going up a Detroit guy, and that may have been the play you're referencing against Mahomes.
Yeah, it was just – the team was just so, to me, inferior skill-wise and athletically than the Bulls. But they just didn't have – outside of Jordan, everyone was just so filled with fear outside of Jordan and Paxson that they just couldn't get over him. And, you know, another thing I forgot is Paxson missed that Game 7. The migraine game. I was unaware of that. And, you know, Craig Hodges had a horrible game, 3-13. I loved Craig Hodges, but he was terrible in that game. And that's the other thing. But that game was so disheartening and disappointing. I think that was, they scored 74 points. I think that was like a, almost like a record. It was 4 points higher than the lowest in playoff history. It was such a thorough, demoralizing beatdown. To go from that 1 year later to sweep them, it's just, it's hard to describe, but yeah, it was just a really good thing reliving that, and I'm glad my son got to see it.
Well, the Bulls shot 31% in that game, Game 7. They made 28 field goals. Michael had 13 of them. So everyone focuses on Scotty being bad, and he rightfully was pretty damn terrible. So, but so was Horace Grant from an offensive standpoint. You mentioned Craig Hodges. He was 3 of 13. No John Paxson in that game. The bench really didn't give the Bulls much of anything. Not that they had a strong bench outside of probably BJ Armstrong at that point. So, yeah, the team didn't show up. The Pistons got there. They got their comeuppance a year later, but it was the Pistons' time at that time. The Bulls weren't ready, clearly, from a maturity and a physical standpoint. And I love the fact that they had that that montage of the Bulls basically just getting in the gym and just working hard and just essentially throwing on the pounds in the gym just to go out there and beat the shit out of the Detroit Pistons. That made me happy. And once they finally did, I was glad to see the back end of Bill Laimbeer, Isaiah Thomas, and the whole handshake thing got brought up again. And just everything about that era of Pistons basketball, the bad boys, and John Sally just coming on and suggesting that they broke up the party or the NBA's plan about Michael Jordan being the eventual successor, and no one wanted the Pistons there and winning championships. And like you said, no one wanted them there because they were a team of mugs who just played like absolute fools. So
I wanted to note about that walking off scene. And this is of utmost importance. My good friend Tim Gallagher, basketball historian and avid follower of that that period of basketball in particular, quote, this is an actual quote from a text he sent to me. One thing that's not being said or being said enough is that the Celtics walked off the floor in Detroit on the road in hostile territory, where the Pistons' shameful walk off was versus the Bulls was on the Pistons' home court. And I think his implication was at that time there were still people who would run out to the court after they win a game like that. And it made it far less acceptable where it was done. When they walked off on their home court, it was just – and they showed it. They showed the clips of Michael shaking hands after losing. I really thought that was really well done. And Michael, this is somehow – I didn't think it was possible to love Michael even more after episodes 1 and 2, but I love him more now after 3 and 4.
Yeah, and look, I completely agree, and this is a ridiculous reason why, but for whatever reason, in episodes 3 and 4, Jordan was just swearing off this. He was just going off swearing every second sentence was said, you know, profanity-laced sentences. And for whatever reason, I was gravitizing more to Jordan because of that, for whatever reason. And he would recall whatever memory it was, and he would just drop a couple F-bombs here and there. And every time he did, I just fell more in love with Michael Jordan for the most ridiculous of reasons. But he comes away looking even better. I don't know where he got this thought that people would be thinking less of Michael Jordan, maybe the younger generation. But for us who beloved him already, I mean, his legend is only going to grow from this, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I think so. I've heard rumors that it gets a little bit worse for Michael as he becomes a little bit more belligerent throughout this episodes 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes, you know. But I completely agree with you. Like I posed this question on Twitter the other day. Like, what player do you feel like? What central figure do you feel better about? And I had Pippen, Jordan, Phil Jackson, and Krause. I couldn't believe Krause even got 7%, but he managed to get 7%, I think it was. I'll go back and look at it. And then it was Jordan by a landslide. He's just – I'm glad I you know what I also found is I think his interviews have been really insightful. I think he's done a great job answering questions. I was kind of shocked to see him in this light, you know, because I always thought he was really measured, not necessarily super honest or super – what's the word I'm trying to look for? Super insightful. You know what I mean? Like, I wasn't really getting understanding who he was a ton of times. I think this has been just, it's so much better than I expected. Like, every time I watch, I'm just smiling. And I've watched it like 4 or 5 times each episode. So, this is great stuff.
Yeah, man. I mean, you get that sense when when you watch the footage of him going back in the early 90s when he's answering questions about, you know, Scotty's trade demand as an example. He would just placate the media with some very basic stuff, not necessarily saying anything, but just filling time and essentially just giving a quote here and there on whatever it was, but he was saying nothing. Whereas you compare that to the Michael that we're getting now, where he's just extremely candid, sharing his side of the story. And like I said, just dropping a few F-bombs just for added measure there and just to emphasize his point. I mean, it is a bit of an insight that we haven't necessarily seen before and just only adds to the legend that he was, this psychotic, ruthless competitor, which we all love him for. But it was fun to watch, and it was great to see the Bulls obviously overcome the Pistons in this episode, which ultimately led to the final scenes, I guess, where it showed or showcased the Bulls winning their first title. And I think what was very illuminating through that as well was we got to see, I mean, we just talked about how the Pistons behaved after losing, but you sort of contrast that to the way that Magic handled it, how the Lakers, after losing to the Bulls, you know, essentially losing the last 4 games, there was an opportunity for Magic and the Lakers to be very salty about it, given that their dynasty was ending at that point. But the way that Magic came across in this episode, the way he handled that loss, that epic bad loss for the Lakers in 91 with such humility, I thought that was interesting as well.
Yeah, Magic was fantastic. Just a few things about this doc that leads to incorrect assumptions. That's one of them. Like, you know, Scotty played great on Magic in Game 2, but Magic was fantastic in that series. He played fantastic in Game 3, 4, and 5. He had 20 assists in Game 5. He had like a 22 and 10, 22 or 23 and 11 in Games 3 and 4. He was great in that series. So it's not like he was just completely shut down by arguably the best perimeter defender in basketball. You know, those are little things that I have issue with. I also have an issue with it. You know, Tony Kukoc has been barely mentioned in the first four hours of this series. I think that's a travesty. You know, a couple statements by Michael even yesterday, you know, leave me alone out there when he was talking about Dennis Rodman. You know, MJ had Tony. He played very well that year. I think he deserved a little bit more respect than that. But those are really minor complaints. I'm hopeful and likely I better be certain that they're going to give Tony his share, his dues, because he definitely came through when it mattered most in these series.
Yeah, I think we'll get that as we move through. Clearly, they're sort of going back through the archives here. It was a Rodman feature episode initially in episode 3 to set up, obviously, his influence on that second three-peat, but there was obviously that connection with him and the Bad Boys Pistons and how the Bulls obviously needed to overcome them to start their winning ways. And that was the lead-up through episode 4 into, you know, championships 1. We may get championships 2 and 3 in the next coming episodes. And from there, I would imagine we go back into the second three-peat where we get more of Tony, more of Steve Kerr, more Dennis and those sorts of things. So I think that'll be probably how it's all structured, I would imagine, or how I'm guessing. But to your point as well, I mean, another thing I didn't really love about this documentary was how they were sort of shaping it up that Michael in all of a sudden in game five decided he was going to pass to his open teammates and find his open teammates, like they made it seem like he wasn't doing throughout the rest of the playoffs, and when he was finding John Paxson in the final quarter there for a few open jump shots for Paxson to knock down. But I mean, he had 10 assists in game five there against the Lakers in 91, but he had, in those five games, he was essentially averaging double digits in assists during that series. He had 12 assists in the first game, 13 assists in game two. He had 13 assists in game four. But for whatever reason, the way it was sort of positioned was he was finding his open teammates in game five, and at that point decided to embrace the triangle and embrace finding his teammates. So I thought that was kind of weird, given that not only was he scoring a bucket load of points against the Lakers in that final series, but he was also dishing and essentially almost coming close to averaging a triple-double that series.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, I think that was part of the, if you read the Jordan rules, it's kind of like what that book starts out with about how, you know, suddenly, hey, who's open, Michael? And Phil's telling him it's John. You know, then he gets some. John had a fantastic game five, 20 points, and the Bulls win. But I agree with you, too. I think, you know, it's partly for entertainment purposes. That's why they set it up. But it's going to be really interesting to see where they go in the next couple episodes. I want Tony to get his due. I really feel like he's been kind of sold short a little bit so far.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll come. But did you notice how open John Paxson was on those jump shots and how revered he was because of he was able to knock down some easy mid-range jumpers when the Bulls were up 3-1? Did you notice that?
I didn't notice that. I did notice, though, that Michael seemed to like to pass to him. So, and you ever, Michael loved John Paxson. So you could tell it's eminently clear, and I can't wait to see what he does in Game 6 against the Suns in 93. That'll be a real highlight for you. And I love every time something like this happens, I tweet out, Paxson, reputation restored.
Not at all. Not even close. I mean, it's people like you. I was reading this morning on Twitter for whatever reason. I woke up scrolling through Twitter, and I was reading some nonsense about how people were calling John Paxson clutch because of his performance in Game 5 of the 91 playoffs. I'm like, are you kidding me? The man was as open as he possibly can be. Magic Johnson wasn't even interested in guarding John Paxson, and he was hitting the most basic of jump shots anyone, same, even some hacks down at the YMCA could hit.
Oh, come on.
But then what they're banging on about the clutch genes that John Paxson has. And then there's people like you, Jumpy, on Twitter talking about Paxson's reputation being restored and all this nonsense. I'm prepared to give him bloody 1993 and the shot that he had in 1993. But anyone banging on about his performance about in game five of the 91 playoffs, where he was just draining these most open of jump shots you could possibly imagine when the Bulls all but had every possibility of winning the championship, being up 3-1 at that point. I mean, I don't want to hear any of that for 91.
Well, I think that's kind of unfair, Mark. I mean, if you go back to 06, 07 and when the, you know, Ben Gordon was getting double teamed and the great Kirk Heinrich had the opportunity to hit open J's, he would brick them at a continual pace. And it was very disappointing for me to watch that. I know it's something you might have forgotten, but, you know, sometimes the moment can get too big for even players like the great Kirk Heinrich.
You put Kirk Heinrich in John Paxson's position in 1991, and Kirk Heinrich is the most revered Chicago Bull of all time. He already is one of the most. He's a top three Chicago Bull already.
I think it was possible if Kirk was on that 91 team, the Lakers win in seven. I hate to say it.
Oh. Well, put Ryan Arcidiacono there instead of John Paxson. You're getting a sweep in that case. So, well, John Paxson, the biggest grifter in Chicago Bulls history. But that pretty much were my thoughts on episodes 3 and 4. I watched it back multiple times again. I don't know how people watch it initially and then get on a podcast and then offer their thoughts straight away. I need to go back and rewatch these things because there's so much to digest. But do you have any other points that you wanted to point out about episodes 3 and 4, and what are you looking forward to in episodes 5 and 6?
One of the quotes that really stuck out with me was from B.J. Armstrong, who I thought did a really good job. And one of his quotes was, "More than any other player, Scottie benefited from playing with Michael Jordan," end quote. And I don't think that was remotely hammered home enough in the first episode. I think it almost left people with the impression that Michael calling Scottie, you know, being selfish, you know, it just was a real, you know, really promoting Scottie episode, those first ones. And he deserves a lot. Don't get me wrong. He's one of the greatest players of all time. But I do disagree with the thought that Scottie Pippen was ever one of the top five players in the NBA during any of those years. In fact, he didn't even make the All-Star team in 1991. He was not the best player on the team in the league at all in 94. Hakeem Olajuwon was a better basketball player. He was probably the best player in the league during those 2 years. I don't think that can be argued. You know, like, I think there's been a little bit of rewriting of history, how good Scotty was. He absolutely was an incredible player. Don't get me wrong. He's a top 10 player, especially at those times. But he wasn't held in the Charles Barkley, you know, that tier at that point. I think that's not a true statement or anywhere near accurate. Maybe in 93, 94, he probably finished and he did get votes for MVP. I don't recall off the top of my head who won it. It was probably David Robinson or Hakeem Olajuwon. But he wasn't at that height. He was never the best player outside of Michael Jordan.
He was definitely a top five player in 93, 94 in that period, I thought. And if not top five, and very much top 10. He was clearly an MVP candidate at that point. Whether he was a top 10 player when in the early 90s, maybe not. I that's up for debate. But for some reason, I've got a feeling that for whatever reason, in being your mate for the last how many years, you happen to be one of the most biased people I know. And I'm getting the sense that Pippen's antics in 94 or whatever it was against the Knicks, where he decided to sit out and decided to sort of sit out those 1.8 seconds, that and as well as maybe these trade rumors and the things that we're learning through The Last Dance, that all of that has maybe swayed your opinion of who Scottie Pippen was or how good he was. And maybe you're on a bit of a media tour here at the moment in terms of trying to maybe not diminish who Scottie Pippen is, but maybe just trying to limit the greatness of Scottie Pippen. Now, that's the way I'm interpreting it, at least, because you have gone out of your way to sort of try to discredit Scottie on a couple of items here.
Well, look at I'm not trying to discredit him. I feel, though, I'm almost forced into it because there's been far too much. Michael didn't do anything without Scottie, and that's just not remotely true. I think there was a massive chasm between Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen. And that's not to me like criticizing Pippen. It's just that it's not even close. Like, Michael was the.
But is anyone saying it's close?
I think there's a lot of effort to say, you know, like he was the ultimate teammate. And in my opinion, Michael, like what BJ said, I think he really made Scottie, or helped to make Scottie. I think he took him by the collar and said, "You're coming with me." And it took a while for Scottie to really believe it. And don't get me wrong, he absolutely achieved greatness without Michael. But I don't think he was in that rare era that Michael was in. I think there were players at that period. So looking at the 93-94 NBA Player of the Year awards, Most Valuable Player awards, Hakeem Olajuwon won it that year at the age of 31. He had 66 first-place votes. Number two was David Robinson with 24 first-place votes for the Spurs. And number three was Scottie Pippen with 7. Shaq had 3. Patrick Ewing had 1. So quite a bit of disparity there. Win shares, Pippen was the lowest out of the top 5. I'm not going to go on an effort to diminish him for that season. He was great. But there's a reason I always say that Phil asked Tony to shoot the ball at 1.8 left. I'll just end it on that. I know I'm losing fans here by the minute.
You're not going to convince me otherwise. There's Scotty has clearly done something to irk you in the past, and I dare say it was that incident where he decided to sit out, and that maybe changed your perceptions of who he was. And I'm on to you, Fred, is all I'm saying.
There's no doubt that
I don't think anyone is painting the picture that Scotty is of a similar ilk to Michael Jordan, so you don't need to combat that position, because I don't think it's one that's that many actual sane people are actually positioning.
Okay, that's a fair enough statement. this has been always entertaining as usual.
Always entertaining. Always entertaining. We may as well drop it there, Fred. We'll leave it there. We'll come back next week, because we were initially doing it every couple of weeks here during this whole COVID-19 nonsense. But given that The Last Dance has been going on, we've moved back to a weekly schedule. So we'll be back next week. But I appreciate you coming on this episode, Frederick, as you have been doing for the last few months as my co-host going forward, the Scotty to my Michael Jordan. Clearly, as you sort of suggested, Scotty is definitely not on the same level as Michael Jordan, and I would concur for obvious reasons, and hence why I think that comparison is apt in this scenario. But I do appreciate you coming along for the ride, and I do appreciate myself lifting you as a podcaster during this period.
Well, I would counter with a big thank you to the sports psychologist over at NBC Sports Chicago for providing us with that personality test, which showed I am Michael Jordan and Mark is Jerry Krause. Hey, he was a good GM, Mark.
Yeah, he did good, some good stuff. He did some good stuff.
Oh, I love it. Good stuff.
Oh my god. That's a great place to live. That's a great place to end it. Bulls fans, if you've been tuning into this one, hopefully you've enjoyed it. You can follow Fred for all his wisdom and his takes on Twitter at CBFred. You can listen to him on his own podcast as well, Chicago Bulls Eye. If you can't get enough of Fred, you can follow him over there too. Follow me on Twitter while you're doing it at MK Hoops. Follow the show on Twitter too at Bulls HQ Pod. On Twitter. That is just about all for this episode of Bulls HQ. We hope you enjoyed it. We hope you're staying safe out there. We'll catch you all again next week. Speak soon, Bulls fans.